This webcast is sponsored by...
I'm only kidding, I haven't got a sponsor.
But if you search Shay Kelly on Amazon, you'll see my books. You can buy them if you want. My mum says they're really good. Do you really have nothing better to do with your life than listen to me talk to behaviour experts about dogs? Then this is your kind of show. Sit yourself down, eardrums at the ready, we're going in.
Hello everyone, welcome to Just Shaying. This week, my special guest is Dale Ward, all the way from North Carolina. Dale's a trainer and behaviour consultant, has a BA and a Master's, a certified professional dog trainer and graduate of Animal Behaviour College, certified by Victoria Stilwell Positively Dog Training. I wish you'd change the name of that. I always struggle to say it. Certified fear-free professional dog trainer, certified animal trainer with ICANN, International Companion Animal Network, certified in canine first aid and CPR, member of the Pet Professional Guild, supporting member of International Association of Behaviour Consultants, contributes to Positively Expert blog on positively.com, presenter on a variety of topics, such as volunteering in a shelter, setting up bark-free shelter program, So You Adopted a Dog, and Canine Body Language, author of Raising the Worst Dog Ever, a survival guide, 2020 winner of the Dog Writers Association of America competition, and has appeared on many dog-related podcasts, but has long held a dream to appear on Just Shaying podcast.
Yes.
Thanks for joining us, Dale. How are you?
I'm very well. How about you?
I'm brilliant, thanks.
Good.
Just enjoying the weather and enjoying doing these podcasts. I always expect the person not to turn up, so we're still on 100% so far each week.
Awesome.
Dale, how did you come to, probably the thing most people know you for, and certainly the thing that I first knew you for, is writing the book. So how did you come to write a book with such an unusual title of Raising the Worst Dog Ever?
Yeah, the book is about, it's a bit different than most, you know, run-of-the-mill dog training books. It's a combination of the story of my dog and me, my dog Wiley, before I was a dog trainer. So, and the way the book is structured, I think, is unique in our little dog industry here, where it combines a real life story, so a chapter on a story of something that happened to us, followed by the training that would have helped that. So that's the way the book is divided. When I was raising Wiley, who was a Black Labrador Retriever, and again, before I was a dog trainer, I had never even had a dog before, since childhood, basically. So 20 some years without a dog. And then I get this brilliant idea to get a Labrador Retriever.
So, and your first
it was
dog.
A field lab. I didn't know there were English labs and field labs back then, but it was an American field lab. And I had no idea what I was doing. And she was a wild child. She just loved everything, doing everything, outgoing. But she was really, really difficult to handle for me. I didn't know what I was doing. And so she's the one, like many of us, we have that one dog that has taught us a lot. And she ended up sort of pushing me towards dog training, because I really didn't have a choice. I had to find a way to train this dog and to live with her. And then once I became a dog trainer, so many people that I met, clients that I met, were running into exactly the same thing that I was running into. It's the same issues of the unruly adolescent dog. Don't know what to do with them. They're big, they're knocking over kids, the usual stuff. And I thought, wow, my story of me and Wiley could really help these people understand, number one, that they're not alone, that their dog is not, you know, some alien dog that, you know, they don't know what to do with. Their dog is pretty normal. And what they're trying to do and cope with is pretty normal. And somebody else has gone through it. And there's a way to work with that. So that's, I think, really was the impetus to write it, apart from, you know, honoring my dog, which is really the main goal for me, was to write Wiley's story. So I really wanted to do that. I started to have the idea probably about 2 years before she died. Spoiler alert, she passed away like quite a while ago. It's like, I don't want anybody to think they're going to get a story that doesn't end. But, you know, as we all know, we choose these lives with our dogs, and they're never long enough. I just wanted to share that that story with the world, I think, you know, and do her justice. That's my main thing. I wanted to get Wiley out there.
It's interesting as well that you had a lab, because and you still have this experience, because a lot of people would think a lab is probably would have this idea that a lab is the easiest dog you could have. It's one of the more popular dogs in, I think, in America and in England. It's been one of the more popular dogs, and people see a well-behaved lab and think, oh, I want one of those, don't they?
Right. Yeah.
You had quite a different experience.
Yes. And it's also the number one breed that ends up in a rescue situation or shelter situation, because so many of them are given up at that adolescent age. I work with an organization here called Lab Rescue, and it serves sort of the part of the East Coast of the US. And they take in Labrador Retrievers from the people that need to rehome them for whatever reason. And then they also go get them in shelters. They pull them from shelters. And every year they're rehoming over 1,000 labs. So it's, there are a lot of them out there. A lot of people think they want this kind of dog, but they don't realize that when they see a really well-trained Labrador, there's a lot of work went into that. They don't come like that. They're puppies for a very long time, and they're exuberant, enthusiastic. And for some people, that's really, really hard to live with. You know, especially people with small kids think, oh, it's going to be a great dog for my kids. And then they end up with kids that are being bowled over in the yard. And so it's people have a big misconception about how, quote unquote, easy Labradors are, because, you know, they're not.
Yeah. And in my own personal experience, because I've got a lab as well, I would say, I'm only going off my own dog, but quite a mature dog as well. Obviously, we breed dogs not to mature greatly, and they stay quite infantile, most of them, for a long time. But I think labs can be particularly that way, far, far less mature than, say, my West Island Terrier, who's much more, she plays, but she's much more serious dog, where the lab is much more of a big baby, should we say.
Yeah, they seem to stay puppies for a long, long time. Yeah, for sure. I love that about them. That's why they're my favorites.
I used to be a German Shepherd man, but since having Mr. B, Labradors are absolutely my favorites now. It's just he stole my heart.
Oh, look at that. We got that in common, that's for sure.
Absolutely. I was speaking to, your book must have been pretty good. Because, and that's hard for an author to say about their own work, so I'll say it. But I was only talking last week on the show to Terry Hayward about, we got talking about reviews that people leave on books and however good a book is. And I'm talking about, you know, brilliant people like Gene Donaldson, who we all absolutely adore. You'll still find bad reviews on their books. And when I went and looked on yours, there wasn't any.
Right.
And I was only talking last week saying, well, we've all got bad reviews, and I was saying what one of mine was and what one of Terry's was, because I thought it was quite funny. So you've done two things. You've written a phenomenal book, and you've gone through life without pissing anyone off.
So far. And I don't know. And, you know, it's really funny, because when I was writing the book, of course, we all have that angst, like, should I actually publish something out there in the world? Because we all know the armchair critics are out there and they're going to like slam you. And I went back and forth for a long time thinking, do I really want to do this? You know, is it worth it? And what really pushed me forward is Wiley's story. It's like, yep, I want to tell it. So I'm going to be brave and I'm just going to do it. And waiting for the onslaught of, you know, stuff that was going to come my way. And it hasn't come my way, which is like totally amazing. And I'm so grateful that people are enjoying this book. And I think it's also partly because it's a very personal story. So it's, you know, hard to criticize a personal story because it belongs to that person. So I don't know if everybody loves the book that has read it. The reviews that I've gotten back have been like really, really positive. I think they're, you know, 95% or something, 5-star, and, you know, a couple of 4-stars, and that's it. So, yeah, I've got, and, you know, I've gotten reviews and feedback from a really wide variety of people. And I think that's the other thing about this book is people in the dog industry have found it very useful. The veterinary behaviorists over here are recommending it to their puppy clients. Veterinarians are recommending it to their puppy clients. And then trainers are recommending it to their clients as well. And then just people with dogs, you know, people who have dogs that, you know, they pick up the book and they see themselves reflected in the pages. And so I think it's really helping people. And that's the big bonus for me. I mean, I can't ask for anything better than that out of a book that I put out there. So
seems absolutely phenomenal. And so, Dale, we're going to go to a section of the show, which I call Expert in the Room. And this is part where we look at particular interests or specialities that that guests have got and how that can help people who are listening. And so I've looked at a few of your areas, and I was interested in that you did a presentation, is that right? On, so you adopted a dog, is that right?
Yep.
So how is that different from getting a dog in any other way? And why did you choose this as a topic that needed addressing?
That one, I was actually asked to do that by one of the shelters here to help their the people that adopt their dogs. Mm. And so that was kind of a really focused presentation. You know, and it's a canned presentation. I can do it for other people, but in the shelter world, they're trying really, really hard to prevent returns, you know, people that adopt a dog and they have unrealistic expectations, and then end up returning the dog, which is super sad for the dog, sad for the people. It's a terrible emotional thing to go through. And so putting that presentation together was really to set some realistic expectations in terms of, you know, when you adopt a dog, what to expect, behavior changes from what you see in the shelter versus what happens when you get home and the dog settles in.
Yeah.
And then also to try and put out some more positive reinforcement training information for those people so that they, you know, can avoid any kind of punishing situations and really work on bringing the dog through with positive reinforcement training, with relationship building and understanding. So that's what the basis of that presentation is really for.
Yeah, and that process sounds simple, but it can be quite tricky, can't it? The amount of dogs you hear of going out and coming back in again because the people thought they could manage and thought everything, you know, they've got a story in the head of how things will turn out. And as the dog, and to start with, the dog's all right, but as the dog settles in and feels more confident, and or people are paying less attention to the dog, or, you know, life gets in the way and the dog ends up coming back, and some stories of them going out 4 or 5 times.
Yeah.
So there's
absolutely.
And I know rescue organizations are doing a lot more these days than they used to do. to make sure they do stay in their homes. I know Wood Green near me does a hell of a lot in education for the owners and getting the dogs ready to go out and all that sort of thing.
And I think, you know, there's rescue is such an area that's fraught with so many issues. You know, I mean, there's the idea that we want to save them all. There's the idea that, you know, you should never euthanize a dog for behavior issues. And that's not where I stand. I mean, there are certain instances, unfortunately, where a dog is not safe to put out into the community. And, you know, hats off to the people working in rescue and at shelters, because it's a heck of a tough job. I was a volunteer trainer at one of the open admission shelters up here, and I did it for 4 years. And I ended up stopping because I was just burnt out doing it. It's a tough place to be. So, you know, I my hats go off to those people. It's tough, really tough. So
yes, a difficult industry to work in, isn't it? When I worked in Greyhound Rescue for a short while, and just they were not too bad to rehome the Greyhounds, but it was just a constant stream of the dogs coming in. And, the people who were racing the dogs retire them at about 3 or 4 years old, and you see the same people bringing them in, and they didn't even remember the dogs they'd brought in the previous year. It's just a business to them, but for the shelter people, it's heart wrenching, isn't it? What about your this really interested me. Was setting up a bark-free shelter volunteer program.
Yeah.
Now, every shelter I've ever been to, not even shelters, just like holiday kennels and things like that, have always been very noisy places.
Right.
So how would one go about?
Yeah, and that's a bit of a misnomer. That comes from that's a protocol, a Karen Pryor protocol that she had. It used to be available for free. To shelters. Oh. And it's really a bark reduction program.
Yeah.
As opposed to bark free. But you know, that bark free is catchy. So everybody, you know, it's like, oh, I'm gonna look at that. So but it's a really cool idea, and it worked amazingly well. And we had a ton of volunteers, and my part as a volunteer trainer was to work with all of those volunteers. And over the 4 years, I probably trained about, I think I counted up the release forms, you know, I measured the inches of them that I had. And there was about 400 forms that went through there. Now, some people that volunteer come once and then they never come again. And so the volunteers come in and out, you know, but there was always a core of volunteers that were there, and plus some regulars that were there for a while. But we trained those people to, with Karen Pryor's protocol. And it was, when you walk into the shelter, if the dog is quiet, it gets a treat. So that was it. That's all you had to do. So there was no clicking, there was no marking, there was nothing. So very, very quickly, the dogs started to learn that when a person approached, if they were quiet, they would get a reward. And we did this purposely because the idea was, of course, there's going to be barking in the shelter. I mean, they see a bird outside, they might bark at it. If there's somebody in the yard out playing, if they can have visual of that, they might bark. So there's going to be barking. And plus, there's always a new dog arriving. So the new dog has to learn. So it's a constant state of learning for the dogs. Yeah. But what our goal was when the humans walk into the shelter to look at dogs, that they would reduce their barking and sit, as opposed to barking and charging the door. So they'd be waiting for their cookies, which is like awesome. So people would come in and the dogs would be like, oh, yes, I can't wait for that person to get over here. This is awesome. As opposed to the you know, barking, lunging, rushing the door. And that doesn't, of course, mean that it's a, you know, quote unquote, bad dog. It means the dog's overexcited. And that behavior is really not a good indication of what the dog will be like outside of that kennel. But if we can get the dogs to be calmer when humans are in there, they have a way better chance of getting adopted. So it was great. It worked really, really well. It was kind of shocking. I've got some video of, you know, one of the volunteers starting to walk through. And as soon as she shows up, it's like the dogs just let me, okay, we're just going to be quiet now. Cause here comes the cookie lady basically. And so it did, it worked really, really well. And because of the huge number of volunteers we had, it was, they were used to seeing all kinds of people. It wasn't just one person that did this. It was tons of different people. So it let them have the idea that, you know, it didn't matter who was coming in. The chance for some good rewards was always going to be there for them.
Yeah. So. And they're not so overstimulated by seeing new people because they're used to it, I suppose.
Right.
So it's not all about, it's not all about the noise levels. It was more about, from what you say, their chances of being adopted and greeting people in a more appropriate way.
Right. And I do think it really helped with a bit of more calm environment in there, just generally speaking, because it can get really, really loud in there. Mm. So if we can have them any kind of tool that will help reduce the stress and give them some positive experiences, I think is really, it's a good thing. So
the thing I always think of with shelters, kennels, and where there's a lot of dogs in one space is with this noise. And it's always, And in many of them now, you need to wear ear defenders. When I last took my dog into a kennels, it was where I was studying. They had a kennels on site because you couldn't take the dogs into classrooms. You had to wear ear defenders because the noise levels could be so high. And so it just makes you think, if a human needs to wear ear defenders, what effect is long-term housing in kennels having on the other dogs if it's that sort of noise levels? So it's just it's nothing I know a lot about, but it's just something that's always stuck in my head. It might be, I don't know if there's been any research on that. That'd be quite interesting, wouldn't it?
Yeah. I'm sure it contributes to kennel stress for sure. It has to, you know, I mean, it can be deafening in there. And plus those places are usually kind of cavernous, you know, so there's no
echoey.
Very, very echoey, like concrete and metal and stuff. And the ear defenders are a really good idea. We didn't do that when I was doing it. But you could certainly use some earplugs in there for sure. And, you know, dogs have better hearing than us. So I'm sure it's not a very pleasant thing for them. That's for sure. Stressful.
Yeah. So going back to, whilst we're still in Expert in a Room, going back to your book, Raising the Worst Dog Ever, what would be your top tip that you could tell to someone else that you've learned from your experience with your dog that you wrote the book about?
I think for me, when I first got a dog, I thought it was all about obedience, right? Sit down, all that stuff. And what I learned from Wiley is that's so incidental and so, you know, number one, easy to teach a dog to do those things. But what's difficult and what requires more work is understanding the dog in front of you and building the relationship with your dog. That's where I think the focus has to be with people. And to for me, it's when I meet a new client, it's managing their expectations of what this little being in front of them is going to be. So many people have this, you know, they get a new puppy and they have this idea of what it's going to be like to raise that puppy and that the puppy's going to quote unquote listen, which we know, you know, puppies just doing puppy stuff. And so they have a hard time with that. So if I could say anything is to try and, you know, be realistic in what you expect out of your dog. And dogs are dogs. You know, they're always going to be dogs. And that's why we love them. So, yeah, I think that's probably, you know, that's one of the first things when I meet a new client is to just go over, you know, expectations, basically.
Yeah. It reminds me of one of my own experiences, because I was exactly the same as that. I thought it was all about getting the behavior, and sort of the more you learn over the years, you end up doing a bit less of that. Yeah. And I wrote a meme once. I like my memes. That sort of reflected on that, and it said, "I don't want the best. I don't want the best behaved dog. I want the best relationship." Something along those lines. And so that sort of was a reflection of my experience as well. So it sounds pretty similar.
Yeah. Yeah. For sure. Yeah.
And so Dale, we're going to part of the show which I call Enrichment Corner. And so this is where you tell us what enrichment means to you, and or how you ensure your own dogs have an enriched life.
Yeah. And this, I'm probably a little bit different than a lot of people in this regard. People often say, how often do you walk your dogs? And I never walk my dog. I have physical limitations. And there's a whole bunch of us out there that I'm sure feel, there's so many feelings. You feel inadequate. You feel, I'm not doing enough for my dog. I'm not doing what other people do with their dogs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, including me, I feel it all the time. But I'm really lucky here because we have a fenced in acre of land. So there's lots of room for her to run and play. And plus she's, you know, she's a service dog. So she's out with me a lot, but we don't do the typical things that some other people do. But for her, being a Labrador Retriever, you can probably attest to this. One of the biggest enrichment activities for her is eating. she absolutely loves eating. So we do not feed at all out of a bowl. She doesn't even have a food bowl. She has a water bowl and that's all. So her favorites are the Snoop, which I understand some dogs actually stick their tongue in and lick the treats out, but my dog has never done that. She bounces it so they fly out. She's a bounce the Snoop girl. And she gets a licky mat every day. She gets a variety of food. I'm big on feeding not one kind of food at one time. I don't know if you have you interviewed Linda Case yet.
No, but I've just got a new book on.
Yeah, food. It's good too. Yeah. So you know, you'll see in there. If there's one thing that I've learned from Linda, it's to feed a variety of food. So it's like rhubarb is always on at least three different kinds of food. One, I try to keep constant. And then two, I kind of rotate around so that, you know, she develops a good ability to digest all kinds of food. And so there's that. Plus she gets, you know, some bananas, she gets blueberries. And the weirdo that she is, she gets a bowl of lettuce every day. She loves lettuce. I don't know. I think it's got to. Oh, gosh. I mean, she absolutely adores it. Absolutely. For us, we buy romaine. And that's what the lettuce we eat. For her, I just buy heads of iceberg lettuce. And so that's hers. And she goes through a head of iceberg lettuce, I would say, every 4 or 5 days. So she gets her little bowl of that. Wow. I started this because I got the idea. She's always wants to eat grass or, you know, the rose leaves. She loves the rose leaves off the rose bushes. And so I got the idea. So I wonder if she'd like some greens. Right. And she does. She adores them all. So she'll eat like spinach and any greens she just absolutely adores. So I thought, well, you know, Mike, it's basically a calorie free thing. So, and she loves it. So why wouldn't I give it to her? So when we make our salad, I get a little bowl and I put her lettuce leaves in. And when we eat dinner, that's one of the things we feed her food combined with the lettuce leaves and every night. And so she has that. She loves it.
That's brilliant.
Yeah. She's it was a kind of a weird discovery, you know. It's like a I
would have said that lettuce, dropping a lettuce leaf is probably one of the few things that Mr. B, my lab, wouldn't bother with. I can't remember if that's happened or if I've just made it up in my head, but now I'm doubting it.
You should try the, you know, up down near the core of the lettuce where it's it's kind of thicker and juicy. Give them a piece of that, because I think it's more like water, crunchy water. You know, so and she loves it, so she can have it. She can have as much as she wants. As a matter of fact, my husband is out today, and on his way home, I have to call him to pick up. I call them lettuce balls, you know, the iceberg lettuce. Yeah. So he has to pick up some lettuce for rhubarb because she's almost out.
I'm gonna have to try it now. He likes his broccoli, he likes his carrots, but I've not.
Oh, and then you, I've bet
not
you,
tried.
I bet you,
not tried the lettuce.
I bet he likes it. I bet
and
you.
You
does.
Don't. You don't know how much. I smile when people say that they don't use a bowl for food in feeding at all, because I just don't think you need it.
No, she has lots of toys that she eats out of. Plus, we have these little games where in the morning, she right here beside me, she's got about, I don't know, there must be about a dozen toys beside me. And she made up this game. I didn't make it up. So she'll pick one toy up and then she'll bring it over to me and put it in my lap. And I give her one piece of kibble. And then she goes and gets another toy and brings it and puts it in my lap. And I give her a piece of kibble. And at the end, I have this giant pile of toys on top of me. And then I say, oh, gone when she's brought me all the toys. And then we're done. So she does that almost every morning. She does that.
Too much like me. Because when we use the enrichment food toys, so it might be a Kong, a Kong wishbone, a canine connectables, you've got a lot of little bits that join together. When Mr. B's finished his eating, and when I take the plates out to wash up, he just goes backwards and forwards, getting me the empty food dispenser things and bringing them, and he gets an extra treat for each one he brings back. The little Westie just sits there looking at him and like has never worked it out in all these years that's how you get an extra treat.
Oh gosh, that's hilarious. One thing I wanted to mention about the enrichment activities, I know a lot of people publish, I've seen on YouTube and just on our regular dog things where they do really cool things like take like a paper towel tube and they fold it and they put, you know, stuff in there and they give that to their dog, or they'll take one of those holy roller balls and then wrap up little treats inside little pieces of fabric and stuff them in there, and then the dog has to get them out. And I can't do any of that stuff with my dog because my dog ingests everything. Those things that, I always want to put a caveat on those things, because some dogs will ingest that stuff and some of it can be very dangerous. So
absolutely.
We don't do any of those activities just because I know my dog, and I know if a piece of something smells like food, she'll eat it. It doesn't matter what it is.
So I do a lot of ripping up old cereal boxes, but I put a handful of food in it, and I've done the toilet roll in the past. And those ones where you fold over the ends. But there's two things that I always point out with these. And the first is that if your dog is going to swallow the bits, they should just be ripping it off and spitting it out, not keeping it in their mouth, not chewing it, not, because even with boxes, you don't know what glues they've had on them. They shouldn't be chewing them.
Exactly.
It's just about shredding them really and getting into that. So I wouldn't give them a box just to rip up. I'd give the intention, and if there's any training to it, there's not really, but the dog knows the objective is to get to the food inside and is not eating the cardboard. But if you've got a dog that would do that, it's absolutely not the thing to do. And the second thing that the second error that I see a lot is that people put an absorbent food like peanut butter or something on cardboard, and then you say, I only do it with kibble. Once you've done that, that's soaking into the cardboard. And how do you distinguish food from cardboard? And so two things can happen there. You can encourage the dog to eat the cardboard, which they shouldn't be doing. They shouldn't be eating anything that's not designed to be eaten. And even if they're not doing that, it's a little bit unfair because they then can't get all the food that is there because it's soaked into the cardboard. Right. So it's likely to be harmful or stressful. So I never, in the enrichment group that I run, I never allow posts that do that. It's definitely something to watch out for.
Right, right. So she gets a lot. She's a pretty darn happy dog, that's for sure.
Yeah, and the other thing is, it's always very nice to have you started off by saying yours might not be like most answers. And it's always nice to have those ones because if everyone gave the same sort of answers, we'd just be repeating the same thing every week. So it's nice to see different angles and what different people do. And, you know, everyone's got different needs and different life setups. And it's about doing what we can within that life setup.
Exactly. And like I said, I'm really lucky because we've got a huge fenced yard. So there's lots of room out there. And then she gets out by coming with me. So it's a different kind of, it's a different kind of life. That's all.
It's all enriching, isn't it? Probably a much more enriched life than people who have to go to work. And then they've got to find different ways of enriching their dog's life because we all have to go to work. So it's just different for everybody. You're not going to get one size fits all, are you?
Right.
This is a section of the show that I like. It's called What's Your Beef? And this is where we're going to put the world right. It's your it's your chance to tell us your pet peeve with the industry.
Oh boy, that's a good one. My pet peeve with the industry is probably extremism. People that think in absolutes, I think that's where my pet peeve lies because, you know, life isn't about absolutes. There's life is not black and white. There's full of gray stuff in there. And, to be really rigid in your thinking, especially when you're working with people who are not, you know, in the same headspace as you, who don't have the same knowledge, who don't, have the same understanding, then you sometimes have to meet them where they are and then work with them as opposed to saying, oh, I'm never doing that. Like one of the ones for me around here is some of our developments have underground fence. And that's a shock collar. And at first I would say, well, I don't work with dogs on shock collars, so no. But they're just going to go out right behind me and get an aversive trainer. So not only will that dog be on a shock collar, it'll be on a shock collar plus maybe another shock collar or, you know, on a choker or whatever it is. So, so I see my job to say, yes, I'll take that client. And work at educating the client to see, you know, this is what's happening with your dog. This is why it works. Because a lot of people don't even understand why this is working with their dog. And then they'll say something like, well, it just beeps. It's like, well, the beep is not innocuous, right? The beep is associated with pain. So it's like, it's not what you think. So I've changed a lot of my thinking. You know, as a younger trainer, I was a lot more into the sort of absolute way of thinking. But if I can take on clients that are in that kind of gray area and even educate them a little bit to start thinking about their dogs differently, about thinking about what is actually going on with the methods that they're choosing, I see that as a win for me. It's a win for me if I can pull them over. So I know, and I know some trainers say, no, I'm not working with you. And that used to be me, but it's not me anymore.
I like that. I think I've softened over the years through listening to people. I was very critical to start with, but listening to people like Sarah Fisher, and each time you do it influences you to just be a little bit softer with people, I think. But my example with that, we don't get as many
shock collars or prong collars in England. You do get them, but they're not common. It's notable when I see one because they're not that common.
And they're so common here,
But we still get the thinking in absolutes, because things like the one I think of is the way we've moved on from to using harnesses now. And then you get people overly criticizing people for using a collar. Now, for me, I would never attach a lead to a collar anymore because I don't feel like it's appropriate. But we end up looking down on people who are at that stage, and they're just at a different stage. I mean, I've said before, my first dog as an adult, first dog I had on my own, lived her life with a choke chain on. So it's not like I've never been there. I've been there on my path, you know, and now I'm at a different place. And if somebody had told me then that I was being cruel or even made that suggestion, I would honestly have thought they were a bit cuckoo. You know, they was barking mad. It's like, how would you dare suggest that I'd be cruel to my dog? Because it's not at all how it felt to me. I was just doing what I thought was normal and what everyone did. You know, I didn't really give it a lot of thought, I suppose, but I definitely would have thought it was strange if somebody had ever suggested that was cruel or not right in some way. And even with, you can take that a step further. You can take that to harnesses. My dog had, Mr. B had a canine, a Julius canine harness. But it has a breast strap that comes straight across the chest.
Oh, yeah, you're getting criticized for impinging on the shoulders.
Yeah. Now I use a perfect fit one, which I do find better. I liked the look of the other one. Strangely, it's not what you use them for, is it? But I liked the look of the other one. But now you get, and I've still got some old photos that I love so much. I still have them there. The one on the top of my website is still one with the breast strap going across. And you get people criticizing you for that. It's like,
yeah,
as if, unless you're perfect to where they are in their journey at that time, then you're open to criticism. And what worries me is that then you scare people off and they're not listening to you anymore. And you know, that you could have people trying to do the best they can, and you could have someone who's persuaded not to use a collar because of the damage it can do yanking or something like that. And then they go out and get a harness, and then someone's shouting at them on social media because it's the wrong type of harness. And, you know, there's a lot of greys, like you say, there's a lot of greys that we miss out on if we just absolute, if we go by absolutes, isn't there?
Yeah. And, you know, just telling people they're wrong or they're doing it, you're not going to get anybody to change anything by doing that. You know, people get defensive and they, you know, get their backs up. So it's just not, and maybe this just comes with age, you know, because it's like, and in my previous life before dog training, I worked with people. So I did tons of interviewing and it was in IT. So it was system design and stuff like that. So it was pulling all these ideas from people and getting people to agree on things. So there's a lot of like negotiating back and forth. And I think that helps me in dog training too, because I know if I just say, no, that's wrong, we're not doing that, then it was like, leave, they're going to say, I'm doing this. So it's much better to negotiate and try and bring people along willingly. It's like dog training. It's positive reinforcement. You know, it's like, okay, I'm going to make you think it's your idea to move forward. Works way better.
And as one of my old lecturers used to say, it's very easy to judge and much more difficult to understand.
Yes, very much so.
And so this section of the show is called, well, I wasn't expecting that. Dale, what would people be surprised to know about you?
That I used to be an ice climber.
Well, that surprised me.
Yeah, I'd say a rock and ice climber, but I was, but I didn't like the rock climbing as much as the ice climbing. So now I just dropped that. And yeah, ice climbing was a big thing for me. Loved it. Just craziness. Yeah, freezing cold, climbing up walls of ice with the big ice axes. And yeah, so.
That sounds bonkers.
Oh, it was so good. The adrenaline rush was incredible.
I bet it was. When I was a kid, growing up on the outskirts of Manchester, a place called Carbrook, Staley Bridge, just outside Manchester in England, there was an old disused quarry. And me and my friend, we must have only been about 7 years old, but these were the days when kids just went off and did whatever. We used to climb up the quarry face of this big quarry. And if I ever drive past there now and look at it, I wouldn't do it now. I'd be absolutely terrified.
But, you're thinking, what was I thinking? Yeah. It's like, how did we ever survive our childhoods? I don't know.
Oh, gosh. Absolutely. I had no fear whatsoever.
No. Well, you know, I'm kind of there now, too. But I did this into my 40s. So I knew what I was getting into and did it anyway. I loved it. I absolutely loved it.
It does sound brilliant. It sounds really exhilarating. So we're moving to favorites.
Favorites.
This is like a quick fire favorites round.
Uh-oh. Okay.
We've got 7 favorites.
Oh.
Favorite dog book.
Favorite dog book. Like a book on dogs? Probably A Dog's Purpose. I love that story. I just love the idea that, you know, the soul of a dog comes back over and over and over. Love that.
Trying to think if I've got that in my collection.
You know, I don't really believe it, but I just love the idea.
Favorite dog breed? I think I know what you're
going to say. Labrador Retriever. Yeah. I mean, that's so easy. Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
My favorite guest already. Favorite thing to teach a dog?
Oh, favorite thing to teach a dog? Gosh, there's so many. That's a tough one. When I work with puppies, probably one of the favorite things is in prep for recall, the follow exercises, which is, you know, just follow me and get some food, and you know trot yourself around the house and the dog follows. I mean, that's just fun. And then, you know, the games you play, you know, catch me if you can, you know, and get them to, you know, run into position for you in a loose leash walking position. Those are really fun. And the people get really excited that they can teach their dog, number one, through games, and number two, to walk nicely beside them without a leash. That's a really rewarding one. That's fun.
Yeah, one of the ones we tend to do here a lot, just a lot of people in industry that I know sort of locally and do, is the hand touch one, where they just touch the palm of your hand with their nose. I think it's a good one for guardians to suddenly see, wow, they're doing it. And it's so quick and easy. I like that one.
Yeah, that's one of the first things I teach puppies for sure. Yeah.
Favorite thing to teach a dog guardian?
Management. That it's not about, you know, sit and down. It's when you get a puppy, because puppies are my thing. So when you get a puppy, it's about managing your environment, basically. So you don't have to run around your puppy saying no, 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 and ruining your relationship.
Absolutely. And so. the more you're in the industry or around dogs or teaching about dogs and learning about dogs, the more these things start to be, well, they just seem obvious to you, don't they? But there's still a lot of people that just don't think of the number of people that still today will say things like, how do I stop the dog chewing my shoes?
Exactly. Yes, absolutely.
Put them somewhere the dog can't chew them. But people just don't. They just don't. It doesn't occur to them. They're not being stupid. It's just doesn't occur to them.
Right. And I'm big on trying also to accommodate people, because, you know, some people, especially, you know, you've got a household of, you know, 5 people, that's a lot of people to try and shape into, you know, changing their behavior to accommodate the dog. Mm. Like there was one guy, they had a golden retriever puppy, and he would come home from work. He was a hard worker, laborer, and he'd be tired and dusty when he'd come home. And his habit was to walk into the living room, sit in his own big chair, and he'd take off his work boots and put them right beside him. And the dog, of course, was, you know, stealing the work boots and, you know, chasing, you know, so it was, he was getting really mad at the dog because the dog wouldn't leave his boots alone. And so we tried, you know, take them off at the front door, and that didn't work because he'd still come in and sit in his, and he didn't want to do that. So, and he would say, okay, yes, while we were in a session, but then he wouldn't do it. Right. So, so we came up with a solution of getting a plastic container with a lid, a really easy lid, you know, one of the open, so that the lid didn't detach, because if the lid detached, it would end up being somewhere else and would defeat the purpose. And it was just the right size to contain his boots. And it was, we put it right beside his chair. And that was easy for him. He sat down, he continued his routine, and he would just take the boots, put them in the container, and close the lid. And that was it. Problem solved. So dog was, you know, prevented from chewing his boots, and he didn't have to change his routine. So that was a win-win.
Brilliant. Favorite person in dog world?
I'm going to say Abigail Whittower, which you probably have never even heard of.
I haven't. That's exactly what I was just going to say. I don't know.
She's a friend and colleague. She's in Alabama here, and we're good friends, but I admire her greatly because she runs a breeding program and a service dog school called the Rover Chase Foundation. And she's dedicating her life basically to raising really amazing dogs and running a school for them and placing them with people who need them. So she's an amazingly awesome trainer. So you need to get her on your show there, Shay.
What was her surname?
Whittower. Whittauer.
I've written it down. I'm gonna do some research afterwards.
Yeah, she's really a cool person, and she's running this amazing program. So,
favorite thing about your job?
Watching people's faces when they realize how absolutely wonderfully brilliant their dog is.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I like that.
That's what keeps me going. I just love those moments when they go, oh, my dog is so smart. Look at that.
Yeah, it's kind of, I'll think about it. It's kind of that moment of realization when they realize they can have this amazing effect and relationship with the dog.
Yeah.
Whereas previously they felt like they're too, you know, they're totally separate. A dog's doing their own thing and they're not influencing that behavior.
Yeah.
And they suddenly realize,
wow. Yeah, it goes from a sort of an adversarial relationship, trying to control the dog, to one where, oh my goodness, look what I can teach my dog. So yeah, that's my favorite one. And it's the look in their eyes. It's like it's like a little kid at Christmas, you know. It's like, oh, this is awesome.
Excellent. Yeah. I've really enjoyed this chat. We're so similar in our in our views. I could have given most of your answers if somebody was just giving it. And we've both got Labradors. So rounding up, where can people find out more about you if you'd like them to?
Sure. You can find me on Facebook and on Instagram under Dale Trains Dogs, Twitter too. I'm not there very much though. And my business is called Dale's Dog Training Academy in North Carolina in the United States. And my website is daleward.positively.com. I also have a website for the book, which is worstdogever.com. And there's tons of information there. It's that you can find out about me. You can find out about Wiley. You could read reviews, look at a whole bunch of pictures of Wiley doing crazy things. And And then I also have, there's a contact there as well. So you can just go there at worstdogever.com and you'll find all of my contact information is there.
Brilliant. And your last question, this is turning into a bit of a theme. How can we make the world a better place?
Oh, boy. Gosh, with what's going on today, it's just such a hard thing to even think about as far as the making the whole world better. I think if we all learned to listen a little bit better, I think that would go a long way to helping just all relationships in general, you know. So the skill of listening and critical thinking. It's like, you know, don't take everything you see at face value, especially on the internet, you know, just dig a little deeper and question everything. There you go. That's a good piece of advice.
Brilliant. There's a saying, isn't there? Something like that. When you speak, you're repeating what you already know. When you listen, you're learning.
Absolutely.
Bear that in mind. So
I can't wait to get back to in-person conferences. It's going to be fun.
Excellent. So thanks so much to my guest, Del Ward. Tune in next time when I'll be talking to another dog behavior expert. Be good. Be kind.
It's been a pleasure.
Be back next week for our new episode. Thanks, Del.
You're welcome. Bye. Have a good
day. Bye, everyone. Bye. Thank you all so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, click the follow button and share with others. If you didn't enjoy the show, write a strongly worded letter. Not to me, obviously. I'm busy.